knižnici. Já jsem od něj dostal dva takové knižní dary a zavázal jsem se, že je tady krátce představím, než bude představen samotný pan profesor kolegou Maslovským. Já pana profesora Hýsena znám už delší dobu. Vím, že na začátku své odborné kariéry se hodně zabýval otázkami makro, sociologie, dokonce právě v té kostnici vedl po dlouhou dobu katedru makrosociologie, ale v posledních, řekněme, 20 letech se stále víc přiklání zejména k problematice kultury a sociologie kultury. Je to asi do určité míry ovlivněné i tím, že on už dlouhou dobu udržuje přátelské a odborné vztahy s významným, řekl bych, asi nejvýznamnějším soudobým americkým sociologem, kterým je Jeffrey Alexander. A spolu právě s Jeffrey Alexandrem z Yaleovy univerzity v New Haven i se podílel na několika výzkumných a knižních projektech. U nás asi z téhle spolupráce mezi profesorem Hýsenem a Jeffrey Alexandrem jsou nejznámější knihy, které jsou věnovány problematice paměti a kulturního traumatu, ale dá se říct, že v poslední době se pozornost pana profesora v té oblasti kulturní sociologie posouvá ještě dál k dalším tématům, řekl bych i v rámci sociologie někdy až, dovolím si říct, exkluzivním. Jedna taková reprezentativní práce, která vypovídá o tom, kam se dostal pan profesor ve své sociologii v poslední době, je tahleta knížka Zwischenlagen, což je kniha
In Betweeners.
To je v podstatě kniha, má podtitul Mimořádné jako základ sociální skutečnosti. Takže on se tady zabývá některými mimořádnými, neobvyklými jevy, které obvykle pozornosti sociologů unikají, aby na nich ukázal, že jsou to jevy, které nějakým způsobem, podstatným způsobem o sociální realitě dokážou vypovídat. Já si vzpomínám, že když jsem byl v Kostnici, tak jsem slyšel několik témat právě, která jsou jaksi zpracována v téhle knize v podobě přednášek. Takže jedna z těch přednášek se například týkala odpadu. Co to znamená odpad pro lidskou společnost? Druhá z těch přednášek se například týkala problematiky neobvyklého v podobě monster, v podobě fakes, kdy ukazoval i, řekl bych, z historicko-sociologické perspektivy na to, že vlastně po první světové válce se evropské ulice zaplnily válečnými invalidy, kteří vlastně úplně proměnili pohled lidí na tohleto téma. Takže to jsou věci, které pan profesor v poslední době tady zpracovává a já osobně čekám, že i jeho dnešní přednáška bude orientovaná tímhletím způsobem. Takže já teď předávám slovo kolegovi Maslovskému, který vlastně pro nás pořádá ten seriál, ten kurz setkání s názvem Historicko-sociologické konfrontace.
Thank you. Dear guests, we are very happy today to have Professor Hýsen as a guest. I will not really introduce you because actually you were very extensively introduced by Yishi Schubert when he was speaking about your books. Maybe I would just underline that you are working on such research program as a question of the national and cultural identities, the memory cultures, the norm and symbols. Correct me if you want to add something, or the cultural foundations of integration or the cultural trauma. And you are a very frequent guest of American universities, as it was already explained, but as well such universities as the European University Institute in Florence and many others. So thank you very much for coming, for accepting to have this lecture, and I propose to thank our guests all together.
Thank you very much for this kind introduction. In particular, Jiri, I'm not even able to tell you that this was exaggerated or a blunt lie. I couldn't understand it, which is really an awful drawback here in this situation right now. But in spite of all these certainly exaggerated, certainly even false introductory remarks, I would like to jump immediately into my talk, which is on in-betweenness and ambivalence as the basis of social reality. Social action presupposes a cultural order, we can agree on that, I think, that is generated, this order is generated by applying distinctions and classifications to what we could conceive of a kind of raw reality. Both sides of a distinction refer to contrasting or oppositional meanings that by this very opposition constitute each other. Inside, hints at outside, past at future, equality at inequality, salvation at condemnation, rationality at irrationality, and so on. We do not know the meaning of a concept unless we can conceive of its opposite. In our regular thinking, we tend, however, not to refer to this opposite that is usually excluded or be silenced, another possibility that is not mentioned. Thus, reconstructing the excluded other becomes a kind of royal path of post-structuralist thinking and reasoning. While this reconstruction of the excluded other of an opposition has been widely accepted, the space in between the opposites, the third possibility, the transition between inside and outside, the neither nor, or the as well as, the space of hybridity has been only marginally theorized by mainstream cultural sociology, but it has been centered by non-sociologist authors like Omi Bhabha, Gilles Deleuze, Michel Serres, or Yuri Lotman. My following talk deals with this extraordinary space in between the opposites. It focuses on something that transcends the successful ordering and splitting the world into neat binaries, and it maintains that this in-betweenness is essential for the construction of culture. Reality itself provides no firm ground for neat classification, as you know. Therefore, in applying classifications to raw reality, there will always be in a kind of unclassifiable rest. And in specifying meaning, there is no way to achieve absolute clarity and to avoid a rest of fuzziness. Understanding can always fail, interpretation can be disrupted by surprises and resistance, distinctions can hit undecidedness, routines can be diluted, rules can be violated, boundaries between inside and outside can be crossed by nomads, by strangers, they can be questioned by folds and disregarded by parasites, as Michel Serres has brilliantly shown. Even if we define and specify meanings extensively, there will be always some remainder of uncertainty in the relation between signifier and signified, and this uncertainty cannot be dissolved by linguistic operations or means alone. Instead, it can be overcome by deictic gestures, so it seems, pointing to the situation at hand. Traditional sociology has acknowledged the existence of these phenomena of fuzziness and undecidedness, but it has treated them mostly as pathologies, as disturbances or as crises that require stabilizing repairs and counteracting restorations of order. The sociology of ambivalence that I have in mind reverses this position. It claims that ambivalences, disturbances, paradoxes, misunderstandings, exceptions are not just critical risks for social order, but instead that they are indispensable elements of this order. Stability of social order relies not only on neat oppositions, but also on the acceptance of the unclassifiable, of surprises and coincidences, of ambiguity and fuzziness. One way to overcome these problems that are related to this is the invention of empty signifiers. In complex cultural orders, there must be empty signifiers like the concept of God, nature, or reason. Even value orientations like freedom or equality function as such undefinable empty signifiers that are, by their very semantic porousness, open to cover the unclassifiable and the ambiguous. These phenomena of ambivalence do not simply just exist, but they drive the process of social communication. Without surprises and disturbances, communication would lack its focus that catches common attention. Without the irritations of a big given background, there would be no signal, no image, no sign. Without fuzziness, there would be no need and motive for understanding and interpretation. Without deviances and breaches, there would be no awareness of rules. What before has been treated as a crisis of social order, and what indeed is seen by the acting persons mostly as such a crisis, is thus discovered as the indispensable key to the communicative reproduction of cultural order. Before we address this in detail, I will, in the following remarks, talk about various phenomena of in-betweenness to illustrate my theories. Phenomena like such as garbage and monsters, victims and seduction, without claiming that there is an underlying systematic order for this. The outlined notions refer to an elementary in-betweenness, a fundamental ambiguity, an indissoluble remainder that resists to any attempt at unambiguous classification. This in-betweenness is essential and unavoidable for the operation of classifying, ordering, and coding the world. But it is disregarded, it is invisibilized, it is besilenced in the order that is generated by classification. In the natural attitude of everyday life, the world presents itself as neatly ordered. Cultural classification is, however, somehow weirdly aware of this elementary but excluded in-betweenness. It responds to this weirdness by producing order even in the realm that seems to escape from it. It classified the unclassifiable, it describes different kinds of ambiguity, it delineates in-betweenness by symbolic figures. It classifies garbage, imagines monsters, tells the story of the uncanny behind the boundary. A pertinent example for this attempt to cope with elementary ambiguity is our treatment of garbage. Garbage, I insist, is not a problem of public health, although it's treated for length as a problem of hygienics. Garbage, instead, is a scandal for the cultural order of things. It is neither sacred nor profane, and this in-betweenness threatens our cultural order. Garbage is uncanny, like living dead. Its pure and absurd materiality presses us to keep a distance, to remove it in order not to be contaminated by its decay and formlessness. If garbage cannot be removed immediately, its undeniable existence has to be concealed from our eyes and sealed from our noses. As long as garbage can be perceived, it remains scandalous and dangerous. But the removal into nothingness is not the only way of coping with garbage. It can also be retransformed into something that can be located in the realm of usable and classifiable things, or in the realm of the sacred. The first transformation is achieved by recycling. The second occurs by treating garbage as collectibles, as art, as souvenirs. The transformation of garbage into usable profane things follows the logic of separation and elementarization. Disgusting garbage is removed into a space beyond our perception. In these enclosed spaces, the decay of garbage is accelerated until it is dissolved into its elementary components. This elementary stuff that got rid of any memory of its previous form can be encountered again as useful raw material that does not no longer cause disgust. The realm of the profane and consumable things is directed by an increased commandment of presence. Any hint at transitoriness, at unavoidable decay, on the inevitable death by consumption, is here a scandal that can be concealed only by presenting ever new, fresh, and alluring consumables. Garbage represents the death of things, and this death has to be hidden from our eyes. Changing garbage into something sacred does not require material transformation. By contrast, its decay and obvious temporality is counteracted by conservation. Because the sacred is eternal, we have to exempt the objects that embody and represent it from decay. The logic of conservation is supported by the erratic attraction of the sacred as embodied in useless things, art, souvenirs, ruins. Even in its sacralized form, garbage remains in a position of in-betweenness, since it embodies the invisible sacred that represents the whole. We cannot stand the unmediated presence of the sacred, as well as we cannot stand the odor and sight of garbage. The unveiled sight of the sacred would blind us, like Cyresias who watched the goddess Athena bathing. The blind Cyresias was no longer able to cope with his everyday life, but he could foresee the future. Whoever has seen the unveiled sacred is lost for everyday business. Another embodiment of in-betweenness and ambivalence is the monster. You know, sometimes we encounter anormal, enigmatic, irregular phenomena, and our attempts to assimilate these weird phenomena to normality fail. When we are unable to ignore these phenomena or to classify them, then we are facing a monster. This encounter is threatening and dangerous because it disrupts the fragile reality of our social order. We feel pressed to reconstruct the boundary between which we could ban the monstrous phenomena, or if this endeavor fails, we try to escape. In simple cultures, the demonic and monstrous is interpreted mostly as an autonomous source of agency. In this respect, it is similar to the sacred, but in contrast to the, and in distinction to the sacred, it has evil or unclear, at least, intentions. Its true identity and intentions are hidden behind a facade that cannot be trusted. Demons introduce the possibility of deception into the world. Things are not always what they appear to be. Behind the surface, there is a reality that might be stronger than the treacherous appearance. The world is under suspicion. It is driven by vampires and body snatchers, seducers and tricksters, and we are well advised to distrust the surface. As soon as they are visible, demons and monsters can be kept at a distance. They can be expelled and ostracized, banned and stigmatized. This, by the way, holds also true for bodies that by their physical features evidently deviate from the regular and normal scheme. In many ancient cultures, disabled or disfigured children were frequently killed immediately after birth, or they were banned to stay out of sight. Physical distance between the irregular or disfigured persons and the community of normals was to prevent contagion and contamination. Later on, disfigured persons were interned, you know that, into asylums that shielded their shocking sight from regular everyday life. A new mode of coping with monstrous defigurations emerged at the princely courts of early modern Europe. Here, monsters were increasingly treated as curiosities, as miracles of nature, as rare objects for the princely collection. The extraordinary monster loses its awful and shocking impact. It is turned into a harmless sensation presented in a frame that is devoid of all practical considerations. Pure extraordinariness. Thus, the demonological gaze was replaced by the museological one. Dwarfs and giants, defigured persons, or monstrous animals were watched from a close distance, but the thrill of facing the monsters did no longer engender anxiety or fear, but just a pleasing frisson. There was no real danger and no risk of contagion. The bar, the cage, or the chains tamed the monster. We can watch it at a close distance, but we should not touch it. That's an interesting bifurcation. The logic of collecting and exhibiting curiosities was, of course, not confined to princely courts. Wandering circuses and ethnic shows, anatomical museums and zoological gardens continued this museological gaze at monsters on a more popular level. It's quite telling that even in the 19th century, the museological gaze did not distinguish between defigured and handicapped persons and people with a non-white skin. Both were considered as being different from regular people, and this difference stimulated curiosity and amazement. While the museological gaze continued to exist in popular arenas, the 20th century generated also a new way to frame monsters. The monster was again regarded in terms of inferiority, but this inferiority was framed by pity, by condescending charity, and emphatic compassion. The monster was turned into an innocent victim who could claim our support and aid. Victims are embodiments of a very special ambivalence between human beings and profane things. They partake in the sacred nature of humans, but they have been treated as cattle, the killing of which will not engender blood revenge or be seen as a sin by the perpetrators. The imagination of victimhood mirrors this very special in-betweenness, as Agamben has shown 10 years ago. According to this imagination, victims have no face and name. They are denied a proper place within the community. They are expelled and displaced in camps, in the outlands, at the fringe of human communities. Their bodies are submitted to violence and killing. Their story is silenced. Their remainders are burnt to ashes. Nothing should remind of their existence. This state of exception from regular civil rights clashes against our conviction that they are human beings like us. Consequently, we try to reverse this expulsion from the civil community by remembering their name and their story, by compensating their handicaps, by supporting their life ways. Thus, the former expulsion of demonic monsters is turned into an emphatic identification and approachment. The disabled are like us, and we are, in a certain respect, disabled too. The public compassion conceals, however, a paternalistic condescendence. The victims are not on an equal footing with those who advocate and voice their cause. Today, a new class of professionals mediate between the common citizens and their uncommon counter-images. Social workers, medical doctors, welfare officers, nurses take the place that before, in the realm of the demonological gaze, has been occupied by witchcraft doctors and prison guardians. This seemingly inclusive turn does not stop at the boundaries of the human race. Today, not only disabled and disfigured humans, but also wild animals are discovered as victims. What was a dangerous wild beast before is now an endangered species that should not be put behind bars, but live in his natural habitat and have his natural diet. The dragon is transformed into a pet dinosaur. Thus, the demonological gaze is turned into its opposite. The victimological perspective centers a discrepancy between the obvious appearance and a hidden essence, but the evaluation is reversed. Whereas the demonological gaze suspecting a hidden evil core behind a harmless facade, the victimological perspective sees a sacred core behind an abnormal facade. Here too, the ambivalent inconsistency between surface and essence thrust for overcoming, but the evil of the facade does no longer frighten or shock us. Just a second. This attenuation of emotions is generated by media reports about distant victims that avoid too abhorrent images showing the monstrous deformation of victims. Instead, we watch on TV faces that do not differ from our own faces. We listen to voices of reporters and see pictures showing the traces of the evil. Hence, we can, on our sofas, surrender to a mild concernedness. We do not face the horror of victims and we cannot change it. The victimological gaze can be unfolded only from a distance, as Boltanski has shown. Only from a distance we can opt for compassion. Only from a distance we can compensate for the impossibility of intervening. Faced to the dying victims, we would respond by crying, by mutedness, by desperate attempts to aid. Represented and civilized by the media, however, the victims stay at a distance that precludes any shock. The horror is banned by the image. But there are also forms of in-betweenness that, instead of being embodied in figures, are generated by interaction patterns. One of the most important is seduction. Seduction, as I see it, is the opposite to blunt violence and naked truth. It relies on ambivalence, equivocality, in-betweenness. It hints at risk. It lures into a realm beyond the principled world of truth and law, morality and rationality. Seduction is based on multifarious ambiguities and possibilities. It is inspired by dreams and fantasies. It's unreasonable and undecided. It occurs in a transitory space in which extraordinary phenomena may occur, but from which we also may return to the well-known everyday life. Seduction crosses the boundary between the profane sobriety and the imagination of future elation, between the permissible and the forbidden, between the safe and the dangerous. Taking this perspective, the French theorist Baudrillard has centered seduction as a central mode of symbolic order that differs strictly from the natural order of law and rationality. While Baudrillard values seduction and ambivalence as the realm of freedom, the modern imaginary commonly opts for the opposite. Natural order, strict rationality, naked truth. They are treated as a proper frame of reference for social reality, while seduction and disguise are seen as an almost pathological derailing of social interaction. Such derailing of social interaction is attributed to hypocritical pretensions, fake passions, deceptive promises of society. The image of society as a source of deception is rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition. We have lost our original paradise and exchanged it against a world of sin and violence, thus repeating, entangled in society, the sin of Adam that deprived the divine creation of its innocence. The sin of Adam consisted in following Eve's seduction. Hence, seduction marks the loss of paradise and the beginning of history. After this sin, both Adam and Eve got aware that they were naked. Attempting to cover their nakedness, both embarked into a land beyond the natural paradise, into society. Society becomes a realm of false and treacherous life, in which distrust reigns, in which truth is concealed, and in which lies and deceptions rule. Whoever wanted to escape from this world of deception had to return to natural nakedness. Originally, this nakedness represented chastity and liminality, a trespassing of this worldly rules and a step toward salvation by entering the original unity of God and the world. Today, the ideology of nudism still hints at this salvatory core. But not only nudism. We can find this hope to save the world by a return to a primordial core also, for example, in abstract art, in a Bauhaus aesthetic that insists that presenting the raw materials without any kind of disguise as the ultimate that we can aspire for. An abstract art that insists that it is just no imagination of some other world, but basically just the colors are colors. Or a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. That is exactly the core of this primordial hope, or this hope to return to the primordial raw stuff. The original religious transcendence was turned into the early modern epistemology of discovery and disclosure. Instead of searching for divine revelations, the modern scientists thrust for universally valid knowledge about nature beyond the deceptions and idolatry that veil the truth. In contrast to this widespread image of seduction as the origin of falsity and evil, we will, in the following remarks, present seduction as a constitutive and constructive pattern of social interaction, the values of which outweigh its disadvantages. The special in-betweenness of seduction even allows for major breakthroughs in cultural evolution. It started with female seduction and the original sin. Eve's sin is the seduction of Adam, as I already mentioned. By seduction, the paradisical merging of man and nature is replaced by a social relationship. Female seduction marks the end of mythical prehistory and the beginning of history. The story of the expulsion from paradise reflects this, as well as the story about the seduction of Paris by Helen and the mythical war of Troy. Female seduction aimed originally at the savage might of the warrior, later on at the chastity of the priest or the honor of the citizen. When the warrior gives up his resistance and surrendered to erotic pleasures, he becomes impotent as a warrior, as recalled in the mystical story of Samson and Delilah. Successful seduction terminates not only the natural paradise, but also the natural violence between the sexes. But seduction does not always succeed. It presupposes contingency, in contrast to rape and violence. Ancient myth mentions this risk of failure. The seduction of Ulysses by Circe failed. Salome could not seduce John the Baptist. Joseph resisted the seduction of Potiphar's wife, and so on. The resistance of males against female seduction is, however, not just a matter of male superiority. It can also be interpreted in different ways. As Adorno and Horkheimer have pointed out with respect to Ulysses' refusal to accommodate to Circe's seduction, this resistance provides the basis of an autonomous personality. The closure of a person against external influences creates an inner space in which autonomy can unfold, because it's driven by resolve and determination that is not caused by anything external. Female seduction operates not only through glances and smiles, but also through intentionally or unintentionally revealing parts of the female body. Partial nakedness invites to continue and to expect more. Seductive unveiling differs, however, strongly from complete and frontally presented nakedness. The unveiling of parts of the body keeps the indispensable ambivalence, since it can be understood not only as an erotic invitation, but also an unintentional result of negligence, of habits, or even of fashion. The seductive lady can always withdraw by maintaining that she did not mean to invite, and the resisting gentleman can always justify his refusal by claiming that he did not understand this as an invitation. The unequivocality of total nudity, however, violates the ambivalence without which seduction cannot be performed. If men do not comply to the unequivocality of total nudity, they offend in a most embarrassing way those who expose their naked bodies. Complete nudity mates well with voyeurism, but it impedes seduction. It dissolves the realm of allures and temptations, confusions and bewilderments. The situation is reduced to sheer and rude corporality. Instead of artful conversation and hints at possibilities, the unconditional and unequivocal presence is in command. Men appear as seducers in grand manner not before the 17th century. The key figures are the Duc de Lançon, who was executed because of his deed, and Casanova. If we disregard some extraordinary cases as Abelard and the medieval minnesingers, we have to assume that even in medieval times, noblemen mostly relied on speechless violence in sexual matters. From the 17th century onwards, however, direct sexual violence was increasingly replaced by seduction. Speechless corporality, while not vanishing entirely, gave way to courteous communication about possibilities and contingencies. This transition that brought out male seduction was driven by a structural change that turned feudal warriors into courtiers, and that in the princely court turned a close encounter between men and women who were not married to each other into a permanent experience. Violence or distance could no longer regulate gender relationship under these conditions. They had to be replaced by dances and ceremonies, by letters and poems. This shift was fostered and supported by a change in the cultural framing of war. After a century of incessant warfare in Europe, war had lost its heroic aura and was slowly changed into an issue of bodily drill of commoners. Baroque warfare required the mechanical movement of bodies. Mental qualities like courage or daring decisiveness were rather an impediment than a propelling cause. In this context, aristocracy, after being castrated in military matters by the princely sovereign, had to turn to new fields of noble excellence. Thus, the court intrigue substituted the battle, and the exchange of erotic letters began to rival the duel. From now on, Language became the major medium of eroticism. By speech and dance, promises and confessions, flattery and praise, the courtier had to imagine a tempting and confusing space of erotic fulfillment and self-growth, and thus to bring the seduced ones to give up her caution. In male seduction, too, ambivalence and unequivocality are of prime importance. Whoever presents his erotic desire directly and bluntly has lost immediately his course. The desired lady cannot avoid to reject him. Every move has to be performed as to allow also various interpretations. Withdrawal and retreat must be possible, faces have to be safe, honor has to be preserved. Seduction, I told that already, is the contrary of rape, but it's also the contrary of a safe bet. It presupposes a courtly civilization of effects as well as techniques of an indirect communication in which the literal meaning of a speech cannot be taken for its intended one. Here seduction becomes a game of possibilities and promises of staged authenticity, and the players know that they might be the victims of deception and fake. Thus, the ambiguity and ambivalence of seduction generates a very modern mode of sociality. Seduction overcomes the unilaterality of the voyeur's as well as of the rapist's gaze. Desire remains certainly the driving motive, but reciprocity and recognition of the presence of others are indispensable. Seduction marks the exit from the violent state of nature in a similar way as from another perspective, however, the social contract does. Both contract and seduction presuppose a mutual recognition of personal freedom. Both exclude violence and both turn contingencies into binding. While contracting, however, explains society as a normative order resulting from the pursuit of individual utilities, seduction explains social reality as a collective surrendering to the vivid immediacy of a present life world. From this perspective, social integration is possible only insofar as we do no longer insist on facing the naked truth, the great totality, the fundamental injustice, the core of things, but instead accommodate to the superficial phenomena of our life world. By contrast, the immediate look at unveiled naked truth is dangerous. If we would know about what drives us and what is the core of the world, we would be lost for everyday life. If we have already mentioned the mythical figure of Tiresias, who was spelled to blindness after he watched Athena, the goddess of knowledge, bathing. Unmasked and unveiled knowledge may be unbearable and horrible, like the head of the Medusa. This horror of immediate and merciless confrontation, which the unveiled truth has to be prevented by disguise and by indirect communication. Disguise, irony, and seduction impede us to face the monstrous and destructive truth and allow us to come along in everyday life. What holds for the merciless truth about ourselves and the enigmatic core of the external world pertains also for the reckless attempt to realize perfect morality and ideal society. These attempts ended often in monstrous heaps of dead bodies. By contrast, remaining within the confines of everyday life and keeping on our habitual mask can claim to be human. It avoids epistemological, moral, and expressive ventures that are bound to failure and catastrophes. Thank you very much.
So,
what I need is desperately.
Yes. For
exactly.
You or to
write for me.
Can it be green?
It can be green, it can be any color.
So, I will open the second part of our session. It means we're going to begin the part with questions, answers, and comments. Do we have any questions? Yes?
In the theory of modernization and modern society is followed as an important feature of modern society the modern rationality. And it seems to me that in your explanation is this ambiguity or ambivalence followed as a challenge for this modern rationality. So my question is, could you explain more detailed how you see the relation between rationality and ambiguity or ambivalence?
Yes, I will try to do so. First of all, nobody knows really. That makes for the fascination of the concept what rationality means. Neither Weber nor other giants who have tried to attack this beast. But rationality means that we can find a well-founded, well-justified, generally acceptable decision in situations of ambivalence and contingency. This idea is, as I would argue, a futile one. It requires so strict measures for the justification of this decision that it ends up frequently with heaps of dead bodies. And that is exactly the opposite of rationality. That means that we have obviously the nightmare, Goya's nightmare, the famous one, for real, and that should be avoided. I mean, it's not only that rationality is the culprit for what is bad about modernization. It is also our insistence on a perfect society, our insistence on the idea what drives us and what is basically the core of things. There is basically discovery and the attempt to find the core of things is an illusion. Possibly a necessary illusion, but an illusion.
Well, is there another question? Yes, please.
I would have two questions. One regarding the problem also of meaning and signification. And you referred at the beginning of your talk to deictic gestures that are kind of anchoring meaning also in the world, which are not kind of afflicted by the same kind of ambiguity that, for example, language is, or ordinary semantic use of language. And I was thinking about Wittgenstein, and he, in the philosophical investigations, he also discusses the problems of pointing at things. That also in the gesture there is always uncertainty, ambivalence.
Of course.
If I point here, and it's probably not completely clear, am I pointing at you, at the glass, at the table here, and so on. And Wittgenstein's example, I think, is if I'm, for example, pointing to an object, do I mean the color, the form of the object itself? So it seems that also when it comes to the ixis, this kind of certainty crumbles if you look closer enough. We can show, maybe even closer and closer, but we cannot really nail it down what we mean. So this probably maybe complements your argument. The second question relates to the last part on seduction. Because you didn't, you mentioned also the contract theory as a kind of functional equivalent to seduction, or seduction as a functional equivalent to contract theory. And there is not only a striking similarity between those two, but also a strong difference, which also makes probably seduction not very popular as a topic these days. Because whereas contracts presuppose egalitarianism, two equal partners, symmetry of social relations, it seems, and also your examples have shown it, first that seduction seems to be inscribed with a fundamental asymmetry in social relations. There is one who seduces and one who is seducted. Of course, there can also be the game of seduction played maybe between two equals, though they probably change the asymmetrical positions. I don't know. But I would like you to comment more on this asymmetry of the seduction. So first the gestures and then the asymmetry of seduction, which might explain why it's not hugely popular and why we in politics, for example, speak of populism if there are some seductive political leaders and we don't like the way they behave and lead.
Let me start with your last argument. Indeed, there is a point which roughly can be linked to Napoleon's appearance in world history, when seduction is somehow leaving the realm or the arena of eroticism and is attributed to politicians and to political leaders. That indeed couples or links or relates the issue of seduction to the issue of authority. And that means also that asymmetry is irredeemably into it. But the original seduction that reigned in the 17th century was nothing that can be reduced to an asymmetrical power. As soon as this happens, it is no longer seduction, but it is something asymmetrical. In particular, it is something that violates the preconditions of seduction between two free and self-determining individuals who can accept an offer or reject it. And I've mentioned also the mythical stories and narratives of cases in which seduction was rejected. Seduction is the opposite of rape, blunt violence, but it's also the opposite of a safe contract. This is my first answer to your last question. There is, of course, in the relation between a deictic gesture and the reference, a certain space of indeterminacy. And that space is indissoluble. We will never be able to overcome that completely. And that is also something that is in our world generating a space of freedom. So we can also say, okay, now I didn't mean it. And that provides some space for freedom, and there's no such thing as a normative skeleton that nails down society once for all. That is the major message from this last part of my talk.
Yes. When Mr. Schubert asked the first question, you said that the modern rationality is not adequate to give us answers, but I would ask, what is modern rationality? I suspect that the modern age presents a great downfall of philosophy, that rationality as such was reduced to mere instrument of irrational society. If we study philosophy properly, we see that the philosophy pertains to all reality as a whole. It has necessarily true general arguments that have no ambiguity, and they are very, very meaningful, and so far I haven't seen how they could lead to Goya's nightmare. So we should I think we should examine anew the modern society if it's not in fact irrational, and this this might and we should give chance to the to what we know about the reality in general that has no ambiguity at all.
A nice hope, but just give us an example, an illustration.
All right. The society is based on the rule: do as I say, not as I do. There are small truths, for example, that hating people is bad, and there are great truths that violence is bad. However, there are middle truths that, for example, policemen are good, or taxation is good or necessary, or sometimes we have to go into war to spread democracy. And what if these middle truths, these social truths, are in fact lies?
I mean, I would dare to say that, with all respect to the illustrations that you gave, everything from taxation to policemen can be described, narrated, presented, imagined in a different way, and not in a positive way. And your middle truth is a modest truth. It is a modest truth that is somehow following the lines of our everyday common knowledge, common sense.
What if I see policemen or soldiers as men in a colorful costume? Putting on a colorful costume somehow makes an action right that was previously immoral. I would say that that is an inconsistency, that is unreasonable.
Yeah, I mean, but nobody disputes that.
Well, I think the law does.
Sorry?
I think the law does claim that.
I've lost track a little bit.
May I kind of follow up?
Yes, please. I think we're leaving you a little bit the main topic of the conference.
No, I think the previous question was quite interesting, and also because, meanwhile, we participated together in producing the book Ungefähres, approximations, and one of the topics I dealt with was also the question of torture, which seems to be for a long time a kind of absolute truth that torture is bad, the prohibition of torture is necessary, but once there was a big terrorist attack, 9/11 showed it, that in the public discourse the prohibition of torture is questioned and it becomes murky and ambiguous territory. And one can argue with good arguments why torture might be in some situations necessary. And this kind of, I think, makes this point stronger that Bernd is making, that this ambivalence is kind of unavoidable, that moral rules that we kind of attain to as absolute, they can change in situations. And there is, I mean, in modern, I would have to think, for example, when you make the criticism of meaning or of modern rationality. I mean, Husserl wrote this wonderful piece on the crisis of European sciences, which is in fact a crisis of meaning, that the natural sciences impose with their quantification of meaning, they actually are devoiding us of this concept of meaning which connects to the whole, to philosophy, and so on. But it seems that modern sociologists and philosophers did not come up with a convincing solution how they introduce this totality of meaning back into the discourse. And we only have economic rationality, scientific rationality, and so on. And also people like Habermas, I think, with their argument of communicative rationality, there isn't really, not really a kind of absolute normative way how to decide, for example, the question of torture in a kind of discourse that is free from domination. And it also shifts with historical events. So what I want to say is that, yeah, I agree with very much what you said, and that modern rationality, I think, means mostly quantification, classification. The kind of whole is lost, but I don't see it coming back. maybe the answer that Bernard Giesen provides us, that this search for the truth itself, for the solution of these problems of meaning, of fuzziness, of ambivalence, of shifting morality, is in itself an endeavor that is doomed to fail in the end, because that is not the way how social life works.
How could I reject your suggestion?
Yes. So, is there another question? I would have a very small, naive question, because you were making your relation between this ambivalence and a kind of freedom, that it, and using the example of seduction. And my first thought is due to my culture. My culture is done by American films. It is that there is more and more people looking for freedom in relations between, for example, a man and a woman, by the fact that they will live in an ambivalence. The wedding can disappear, living together or not is not very always clear, and so on and so on. There is a research of freedom. But as well in the American films, this ambivalence is seen as a source of danger, as a source of harassment, sexual harassment. He used the word with a double meaning. You have process for this. American professors are afraid that you will know probably better than me. So, what about the danger of the ambivalence?
I mean, my literary background for illustrating the ambivalence of seduction is less the American Hollywood movies, but more La Close, Liaison Dangereuse.
Okay.
That is a perfect description of ambivalence that came up with the seduction, and also with the dangers that are implied in these ambivalences. Nevertheless, I should stress the fact that, as was already mentioned, that ambivalence means also that there is no firm, determined way of following up a certain offer or a suggestion and so on. You can always say no, and you can always withdraw into a space of everyday life. Mm-hmm. Nobody is obliged to do that. So, in the same way as nobody is obliged to sign a contract, you can always say no, I will not. In the Zwischenlagen, I try for some length to show the parallels between contracting and seduction, as the early modern modes of finding a kind of compromise between the realm of freedom on the one hand and the binding agreements that we need nevertheless.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Just a quick follow-up. Because when you mentioned marriage also as a liberation from this uncertainty, or that is one how can view this phenomenon that you described in especially strong in the American culture, that there are also help books how people find the man to marry, and they want to get married quickly, to get out of this state of liminality, out of this state of seduction that has this dangerous, also sexual harassment, rape, and so on. And I had to think of Kant and his definition of marriage as a contract which allows for the mutual use of one's sexual organs. And by entering marriage is basically a contract that kills the dangers of seduction, that kills seduction, maybe eroticism in general. I don't know, I'm not married. But in a certain way, marriage is opposed to seduction. It's a form of contract that eliminates this kind of ground. Even though we have nowadays a different understanding of marriage that Kant has, but this is just too beautiful, marriage as a contract for the sexual. And no one can claim you will harass me because you agreed to the contract that we can use our sexual organs each other anyway.
Thank you.
question or remark. So maybe I will use once again the occasion. So in order to have this ambivalence, we need to have rules, if I understood you well. When creating rules or norms, the hole between the definitions are it's this free space, giving a kind of liberty. But if we enlarge the space of ambivalence, that means that we will have less rules. Will we have less ambivalence as well? If ambivalence is defined by the hole between the rules, if the hole is too large, what will happen to ambivalence?
I mean, the relationship between rules and ambivalence can be conceived of in the following way. Every rule describes or requires a certain way to be a conformist. And you can also violate that. But we have to do, in order to overcome the fundamental ambivalence, we have to decide, for example, if somebody who shows up on his workplace at, let's say, 8:15 or 8:05 is still within the realm of the conformity with the rule, you have to show up at 8 o'clock. And we have to decide about that. So even the clearest rules open up a space of ambivalence where we have to decide. And decisions are important. Decisions is something that is ultimately connected to freedom and also to something that we could call contingency.
But if there are no rules, there are no ambivalence. Am I right?
I mean, we cannot imagine a social reality without rules.
Oh, but we can imagine some spaces where you have less rules.
Yeah, but we have all ready to insist that somebody who seems to violate the rule is backed by the decision. And also it can be the case that we decide that this rule does not apply. There are other rules. So we can shift from one rule to another and decide that this should be the relevant, important rule.
Another question? So, maybe before ending, I would just add this idea that I had when you began your talk. I was thinking about every day I'm hearing about this war in Ukraine, civil war, and all the newspapers are about the fact that it is a question of ambivalence, that all the game is a game of definition. That is opening this space. It's just like a...
But you will not expect from me to solve the problem and...
So, it would be nice.
It would be nice, okay. But I'm a simple, barefooted sociologist. I cannot solve the riddles of this and enigmas of this world.
On this good word, I propose to thank a lot Mr. Gissen. Very interesting talk, and our last meeting of this cycle of lectures this year, this semester, so I wish you a happy summer, and I hope to see you next semester.
Okay.
This was very, very interesting.
Thank you.
But I think that's maybe one.